Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, Sunday morning.
Wait a minute, what is today?
Good morning, Sunday morning.
Wow. Welcome, this is the Patrick Madrid Show, where you never know what kind of conversation you're going to hear here. My number is 888-914-9149. As per usual, we have a lot of folk already on the phones waiting. If you get a busy signal when you call, just hit redial. We'll do our best to get you on the air. 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Peter in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Good morning, Peter. Hello, Peter.
Who's that stumbling around in the dark? State your business or prepare to get winged.
Cyrus, you are so aggressive first thing in the morning.
As soon as I hit that button, I was like, that might be a little aggressive for poor first caller. Oh, Peter, where are you, Peter? I'll pick up with him.
Peter's not there. Okay, well, just a little tutorial. When you get on hold and you get screened, the best thing to do is just be ready to go on the air, because sometimes it can be very unpredictable and you may be on the air faster than you expect it to be. So that's my advice. The number is 888-914-9149. Oh, I see what's happening. Peter's calling back. His cell signal must have dropped. So play me that little bit again about state your business. I want to hear that again.
Are you sure?
And it was you shouting it too.
I think that's right.
Who's that stumbling around in the dark? State your business or prepare to get winged.
You got me on a Western kick with your movie there that you're always quoting.
Movie. I wish it was my movie.
Well, Tombstone's great, and yeah. it just opened the door. So I've been diving into Westerns, and I heard that, and I was like, oh, that's a good one for when callers don't say anything.
Prepared to get winged.
Yeah. Who's that stumbling around in the dark?
Yeah, you could do a pretty good rendition of that. Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know if we're having phone issues, so if you could look into that, because looks like maybe some of the other callers might be having difficulty. But let's get them sorted. In the meantime, I have an email that came in. This is from Laura, and you know what I've noticed, Cyrus, lately, emails are coming to you for some reason that are supposed to go to me. They come to you first.
I don't know why that is. I've noticed that too.
So just FYI, and Laura, a very nice lady who wrote this email, which I'll read in a moment, you sent it to Cyrus. Just send them to me directly. Just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and there you'll see there's it says links, and then it says contact. And where it says contact, that's where you send me an email, and it comes straight to me. I don't mind if they go through Cyrus. That's fine. It doesn't matter to me. But
yeah, you'll still see them. I pass them on. I pass everything on, good, bad, indifferent.
Yeah, we don't have as many. Well, we affectionately call them nasty grams, but we haven't had too many of those recently. I don't know what that means exactly, but we read them all. So if you want to send me a message directly, email wise, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on contact, and you can send an email directly to me. And I invariably share them with Cyrus. So Laura says, Patrick recommended a book called Science and the Afterlife Experience by Chris Carter. My husband ordered the book immediately, thinking it might be a good read for him and an atheist friend of his who has been working converting for several years. When the book arrived, we were surprised to see that it relies heavily on its quote-unquote evidence for an afterlife based on human experiences of reincarnation and with mediums. While mediums are not always liars, the church tells us to stay away from them because of the likelihood of interacting with the more nefarious side of the afterlife and spiritual world, which I suppose could therefore point to the afterlife, but still seems like it could be problematic. We absolutely do not believe in reincarnation. I am hesitant to read a book beyond the book's foreword and introduction. Let's see. Did we order the right book? If so, we are interested to know what Patrick would say about these particular aspects of the book, especially in recommending them as evidence for the afterlife as a Catholic. And then she adds as a postscript, I'm so very much looking forward to meeting him at the fundraiser dinner in Helena, Montana in April. Yes, I look forward to being in Helena, Montana to support our local Relevant Radio affiliate. And anyone who's interested in finding out more about that, just go to the show page, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you can look under links and find the calendar and get more information. So thank you so much, Laura. I appreciate your email. So here's how I would answer it. Number one, the Science in the Afterlife Experience is not a religious book. And I realize from what you wrote that you have only read maybe just the introduction. But if you wanted to read further, and I, of course, would recommend it, what you'll find is that he's taking a scientific approach to the question of, is there some kind of life after death? Or, to put it a different way, is there some kind of spiritual or supernatural, if we can use those terms, realm that is beyond the physical realm, beyond the body, for example? So what he's doing is, yeah, he spends a lot of time looking at reincarnation at the beginning. He spends a lot of time looking at apparitions. So what about Marian apparitions? What about other claims of apparitions? Now, keep in mind, it's not a Catholic book, and he's not writing it. I don't know if he has any religion at all. Personally, I haven't researched that. He's writing this book as a way to survey the phenomena that are out there from a variety of different sources. And reincarnation is one of those phenomena. There are countless people, many of them in India, but of course there are other people around the world who firmly believe that they are reincarnated. Now, like you, I don't believe in reincarnation. As the Bible says, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So you're not going back into a koala bear body and coming back at a higher form of consciousness. You're not learning any lessons from previous lives. You're not dealing with your karmic record from previous lives. You have one shot and this is it. But he's not promoting, this is the thing to understand, he's not promoting reincarnation. He's not promoting mediums. He doesn't even use the word medium or psychic, I think was, I'd have to go back and look at your note. What he's doing is he's saying, here is this body of evidence that includes people who claim reincarnation. It includes people who claim to have had apparitions. It includes people who have had near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. So what he's trying to do here is survey the vast body of phenomena to see if there's any scientific evidence that we can make use of to establish that, yes, there is some kind of supernatural life after this life or above or outside of this life. That's what his project is. So even though, I mean, as a Catholic, you reject reincarnation, and rightly so, in my view at least, and I say this with all due respect, there's no reason to fear this book. I mean, he's not promoting it. He's looking at this through this lens of scientific inquiry. So that's why I think the book has some value. That's why I think the book is at least helpful in bringing to bear some of these scientific inquiries into these phenomena that are varied, not all of it Christian. And that would make sense when you think about it, because if he wants to have, and I don't know the guy, I only know him from what he wrote in this book, but my presumption is that he wants a lot of people to read his book. He wants even scientists and those in the scientific community to read his book. So it would make sense to me that he would try to make his survey as wide as possible and look at objectively and scientifically these various claims. Now, you'll notice too, as you proceed in the book, if you do, and you know, it's not my place to try to urge you to read this book, but it is a book that I found helpful and useful. What you'll notice is that he brings up the countervailing theories. So he will bring up the debunkers and the skeptics, and here's what they say is why this theory can't be correct. And he has a whole lengthy section actually on the theories against reincarnation. Now, he doesn't include dogmatic claims, like what does the church say about this? He's not quoting scripture or anything like that. He's just saying those other scientists or skeptics who don't believe in an out-of-body experience, they don't believe that the consciousness can live after the body dies, etc. What are their claims and counterclaims and refutations and things like that? So that's really what the book is as a whole. Nothing to be afraid of. And I'm not suggesting that you're afraid. I don't mean it in that sense. But if you find it beneficial in understanding some of these issues, great. If it's, for whatever reason, not beneficial, that's not a problem either. I hope that helps. I hope that clarifies it for you. 888-914-9149. I hope we have the phone sorted out. Let's get back to Peter in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning again, Patrick and Cyrus. My apology.
That's so okay.
My question is in regards to my fiance and I were getting married in April, but we're celebrating our reception wedding on Friday the 13th of May, which happens to be Friday. And I wanted to know what the church is teaching on having celebration or music and feasting on, you know, on Lord's Day, which is Friday. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Well, did you say April? Because the 13th is a Wednesday. Easter is
it's
the 17th.
May. It's May.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's May 13th. Yeah, it's okay. The feast of Our Lady of Fatima.
Okay, okay. My mistake. So in that case, because it is not in Lent, I thought at first you were referring to being in Lent, because I thought you said that it was a Friday in Lent. But in any case, it's not in Lent, so it's not a problem in that sense. There would be, of course, the church's custom or discipline of doing penance on Fridays throughout the entire year, and the traditional penance is to not eat meat on Friday. So since you're having a wedding celebration, you could, you don't need to seek a dispensation for that. You could simply substitute something else if you wanted to give up something else on that day. Maybe you give up, you probably don't want to give up your wedding cake because that's part of the whole thing. But, you know, there may be some other act of mortification that you could do. Maybe give up an hour of sleep, get up an hour earlier and pray. So you could substitute something for not eating meat on Friday. If it were during Lent, that'd be a different story. But in this case, you have that freedom to make the substitution.
Okay.
Is that what you're wondering about?
Yes, yeah, so I understand that part. Thank you very much. And but as far as celebrating the wedding, meaning there will be music and people will be having a good time drinking and partying, The church does not see it as something that will be in conflict with the church's law.
To my knowledge, there's no prohibition against anything like that on a Friday throughout the year. So that would be in the season after Easter. But you would run into something like that if it were during Lent. And the church would strongly encourage
Correct.
You to reschedule for a different day. But this is not during Lent. That's why originally I thought that was the issue, but it's not the issue. So in ordinary time,
Okay. You
know, you have the freedom to get married on any day that's, you know, the best day for you to get married. The church doesn't say you can only get married on certain days. So no, there is no prohibition, certainly none that I've ever run into, about having your party afterward and celebrating.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, I wanted to ask, are you familiar with any different churches teaching before the Second Vatican?
Sure, yeah. That's an interesting question. What makes you ask that?
Because of where I come from, and it was this question that I'm asking you today, it was actually asked by my mother, and she, you know, her and I were from Poland, so she basically read it to me when I called her this morning, that you should recognize that it's the Lord's Day, and for that reason, the church's teaching is to not be feasting and partying on the day, which is Friday, and that's why where my question really lies.
I see.
To make sure that I'm aligned with the church's teaching.
Right. Well, I would look at it this way, and I, of course, would be happy to be corrected if a canon lawyer hears what I'm saying and says, wait a minute. There's a canon in there that says thus and so. So I can stand corrected if I'm incorrect on this, but I don't think I am. And I would put it this way, that there's obviously the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Now, what I'm saying is, as far as I know, there is nothing in the letter of the law that prohibits you from having your wedding reception on a Friday. Again, if there's something in there that missed my attention, then I hope someone will correct me on that. But that aside, the letter of the law doesn't forbid it. Now, in the spirit of the law, you may say, well, I want to live that custom of penance on Friday throughout the year as fully as possible. Therefore, I'm not going to have my wedding nor my wedding reception on a Friday. I'll have it on a Saturday or some other day. So you could, so to speak, rise to the occasion and go above and beyond what the church requires from you. And in your own heart, say, I don't want to be making merry on a Friday. The church doesn't say you can't do that. But if you would prefer to be more, you know, maybe more, I don't know if rigorous is the right word for it, but let's just say more rigorous, you certainly have the right to do that. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. All I'm saying is that the church is not saying you can't have your wedding reception on a Friday outside of Lent.
Okay. And yeah, thank you for clarifying that for me. I really appreciate it. And
sure.
Thank you for everything you do every day for us.
Thank you, Peter. Do you mind if I ask you a question? Why have it on a Friday? Why not just push it one day back and get married on Saturday? Or get married on Thursday, or, you know, that way this problem is no longer a problem.
Yes. Yeah, so we're actually only a couple months out from having the celebration, and my fiance is actually traveling this week. So please pray for her to DR to ensure everything is said and done. So, like I said, this question just popped up on the surface as of this morning. I can say that I would like to look into it. And I think the main idea to get married on May 13th was the feast. We were very excited to be married on that day. So, and I,
yeah, that's
like
important.
I said,
that's good.
And plans have changed. So, you know, I decided to give you a buzz, and I know you're always at my disposal, as you say.
I am.
And I appreciate, your answer.
You got it. Well, I hope it's a wonderful, happy celebration. Another thing you could consider, I know it's maybe a little unorthodox, but you could get married on Friday and then have the celebration on Saturday. You know, it's another way to approach it if that would smooth things over. Anyway, I wish you and your wife many happy years. Thank you, Peter. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, and I will be right back, including with you and your phone calls right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
As if things couldn't be more dire for Russia right now, McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Starbucks have all shut their doors, at least temporarily, across Russia. McDonald's has upwards of 900 stores in Russia, from what I'm reading here, looking at an LA Times article. Pepsi hasn't said anything yet. Actually, no, look, it did say it's going to follow suit. Coca-Cola, they're not selling anymore. There must be a huge supply already there, but when that runs dry, same with Starbucks. I'm not a fan of Starbucks. Cyrus, do you enjoy paying $7 for a cup of coffee? I don't.
No, and it what really throws me off every time I drive by the million Starbucks that are around here, there's always a line going around the building.
This is true.
And there's no other coffee places. Like, people don't support the small local shops. In Oregon, where I was from, there was, we had Dutch Brothers. And so there was a competition for Starbucks. It doesn't seem like that exists anywhere else. It's just Starbucks.
Well, here and there and everywhere, you'll find some of the competition. But for me, it's just like, I don't want to spend all that money on that brand name. That's all that is. The coffee's good. It's not, well, I'm going to get myself into controversy if I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I am absolutely A-okay with McDonald's coffee. It didn't used to be good coffee. I mean, for so many years, McDonald's coffee, that'd be the last place you'd want to go to get a cup of coffee. But I don't know, long about 20 years ago or so, somewhere in there, McDonald's made a real commitment to really getting some good coffee that also included quality control, where you could count on the coffee being good at every single location,
and
everywhere.
Hot.
And hot, yeah.
Too hot.
Not always. Not always.
Too hot.
I've had to take a cup of coffee back here or there because it was lukewarm.
You're that guy?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'm that guy to the hilt. And I buy senior coffees now because I can't.
Sir, you ordered an iced coffee. Of course it's cold.
I never do that. But yeah, I just don't want to spend all that money for, you know, a cup of coffee that's tastes good. Yeah, I don't deny it. But I'd say that McDonald's coffee tastes every bit as good. And I can get a senior cup of coffee, a small senior coffee, for 65 cents. Boom. Let's go to Eric in Lacey, Washington. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Patrick. Good morning, Cyrus. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wanted to know, you've been saying for a number of days now that Our Lady of Fatima had asked the Pope to consecrate Russia, and I don't know what that means. I don't know if a lot of people know what that means. Can you explain what it is to consecrate something, and does Russia need to be a willing participant in that?
Well, these are great questions, Eric, and I'm sorry that I never took the time to break it down, so thank you for giving me the opportunity. So a consecration in this context, first let's go back to what was said at Fatima. So in 1917, when she was appearing between the space of May 13th to October 13th, she gave several different secrets or revelations. This is private revelation, of course. It's not binding on anybody, but I think we would be wise to heed it. So the first one is she gave the children a vision of hell and showed them that hell is real and real people go there and it was terrible. The second one is she said that World War One was going to end. And she said a worse and bigger war will happen if people don't pray the rosary and turn back to God and do penance. And then the third part of that second prophecy was she said that Russia is going to spread her errors around the world and cause immense suffering for people, and whole nations will be annihilated. So the Holy Father has to consecrate Russia to her Immaculate Heart of Mary so that in the end her Immaculate Heart would triumph and there would be peace, Russia would be converted, etc. So the consecration would be simply the Pope publicly praying and asking the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary in a public way, a formal public way, and the understanding was that this would include all the bishops of the world would be in union with him, although I don't know that, strictly speaking, that part was necessary. I'd have to go back and look at it. But at the very least, that the Pope would publicly, or in some way that was known that it actually happened, that the Pope would consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, meaning that he would publicly ask for her to convert Russia, and he would dedicate or entrust, might be a better way to say it, the country of Russia, the people of Russia, to her Immaculate Heart. And that is what is meant by the consecration of Russia. And as you probably have gleaned from listening these last week or two, that this controversy has focused on the question of whether or not what Pope John Paul II did, I believe it was in 1986, when he issued a public consecration of the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And some of the hardliners and others said, well, that doesn't count because that's not what she asked for. It didn't specify Russia. So there's a kind of an open debate right now as to whether or not that actually fulfilled this request. I don't know whether it did or not. And I understand the position on both sides. But the fact remains that if any pope were to do that, it would certainly fulfill it, even if it was a second time around kind of thing. So that's what the... that's what this is referring to. Does that make more sense now, Eric?
It does. So that begs the question, if that's all it takes, why, since World War I, has a pope not just gone ahead and done that?
That is the mystery of the ages. That is the mystery of the ages. And it also goes to the question of, is the third secret of Fatima that which was publicly released during the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI? And there are those, again, hardliners who say that's not the third secret of Fatima. Not that they would know, because very few people have actually read it. Now, there are many people who purport to have read it and who say, well, this doesn't add up, because why would she say that this would have to be held until 1960, and then in 1960 that the Pope should publicly announce what's in the secret? And one of the theories is, and I'm not saying that I hold this theory by any means, but one of the prevailing theories is that she warned about Vatican II, and that she warned that the Mass would be changed from the traditional Latin Mass to the new Mass. And she warned about kind of an influx of modernists and Freemasons and those who would try to destroy the church. And a lot of that, I think, is drawing upon what Blessed Anna Catherine Emmerich had to say in her private revelations in the, what was it, the 18th or 19th century. So nobody knows for sure what that third secret of Fatima says, if it's something other than what was released. Some people say that what was released was part of it, but there's more to it that would shed more light on what's going on. Now, as a little tidbit, Pope John the 23rd, who was the Pope in 1960, he allegedly, from accounts of people who were there, read the third secret of Fatima in the late 1950s. I believe he was elected in 58 or 59. And he read it, and the story goes, he read it and he folded the paper back up and he says, well, I'm not going to announce it because this obviously doesn't refer to me. This doesn't refer to my pontificate. So there's a mystery around that. And, you know, that's part of this bigger picture, that if Our Lady asked that this be done and you're the Pope, and you've read the letter that was written by Sister Lucia, in which all this is outlined, and you know what the secret is, why wouldn't you announce it? Why wouldn't you consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary? It's a mysterious question. I don't claim to have the answer for it. You know, we've had some really good popes, Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI come to mind. Pope Pius XII comes to mind as some really good popes. I mean, you know, nobody's perfect, and you know, any given pope can have flaws and do have flaws. So I don't mean to say that they're absolutely perfect, but in any case, why didn't Pope Pius XII do it? I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me. Why didn't John Paul II or Pope Benedict XVI do it? I don't know. I don't understand that. So I'm puzzling over that just like you are, Eric.
Well, perhaps it was some sort of secret that was so profound and earth-shattering, or worse yet, earth-ending, you know? Maybe it's some sort of apocalyptic vision that once Russia becomes consecrated, I don't know, I'm speculating, obviously, but maybe once Russia becomes consecrated, it brings about the end of the world or something like that? I don't know.
I don't know either. I can tell you a few things that Pope John Paul II... he said something in 1980 in Fulda, Germany. And it's been a long time since I've gone back and looked at this, but I had done at one time a kind of, you know, probably Google-based research to determine, did this really happen? I mean, is it corroborated by other evidence? And what he was asked about the third secret of Fatima. So he was in Germany. He was making one of his apostolic visits. And he was asked in the moment, Holy Father, what about the third secret of Fatima? Should it not have already been published by 1960. Now, I believe that this is not only verified by other sources, but if I'm not mistaken, it seems like there's audio of it. Now, he's speaking in German, two Germans, and his response is, quote, "Given the seriousness of the contents, my predecessors in the Petrin office diplomatically preferred to postpone publication so as not to encourage the world power of communism to make certain moves. On the other hand, it should be sufficient for all Christians to know this. If there is a message in which it is written that the oceans will flood whole areas of the earth and that from one moment to the next millions of people will perish, truly the publication of such a message is no longer something to be so much desired." And he also said in that same commentary, he said, "Many wish to know simply from curiosity and a taste for the sensational, but they forget that knowledge also implies responsibility. They only seek the satisfaction of their curiosity, and that is dangerous, if at the same time they are not disposed to do something, and if they are convinced that it is impossible to do anything against evil." And at that moment, the Pope pulled his rosary out of his cassock and said, "Here is the remedy against evil. Pray, 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 and ask for nothing more. Leave everything else to the Mother of God." And then he was asked after that, "Holy Father, what is going to happen to the church?" And he said, "We must prepare ourselves to suffer great trials before long, such as will demand of us a disposition to give up even life and a total dedication to Christ and for Christ. With your and my prayer, it is possible to mitigate this tribulation, but it is no longer possible to avert it, because only thus can the church be effectively renewed. How many times has the renewal of the church sprung from blood?" He's referring to the martyrs. "This time, too, it will not be otherwise. We must be strong and prepared and trust in Christ and his mother and be very, very assiduous in praying the rosary." Now, that incident that took place in Fulda, Germany in 1980 was not quite a year before the assassination attempt took place in Rome. And it was Pope John Paul II said that this was directly connected with the Fatima revelations. In fact, after he had recovered sufficiently from his bullet wounds, he made a pilgrimage, a visit to a Marian shrine, and he took the bullet that Mehmet Ali Agca had shot him, and one of the bullets anyway, that was recovered from his body, and he placed it in the crown of the statue of Our Lady of Fatima as a way to kind of link what happened in Fatima with what happened to him in the assassination attempt. So again, very mysterious, and he seems to suggest that there's more to this than what was publicized. And it, again, a mystery, and I don't know the answer to it. I can only point you to some of these enigmatic details.
Fascinating and sobering.
Indeed.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, I appreciate your phone call. This is a topic that we don't talk about very often, but it's always worthwhile when we do. 888-914-9149. We'll take a break. We'll come right back with more. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, and I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
It's a great song. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Ken now in Miami. Greetings, Ken.
Hi, Patrick. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm feeling a little indignant, so if I'm a little bit choppy with my words, please correct me, but I want to make sure I get in my points.
Okay.
I'm noticing since the Ukraine war began a few weeks ago, there's this tone in Relevant Radio. It's not just your program, but all of them. There's a kind of pietistic distraction I'm noticing a lot of invoking of Fatima, a lot of invoking of the divine mercy, saying, you know, this is all preordained, and Poland will be the flashpoint, and so on and so forth. To me, this is a pietistic distraction, and I think it is, has the effect of letting us as Catholics off the moral hook for this foreign policy crisis that we are now in. There are hard questions that have to be asked and examined about how we got to this point where we are possibly on the verge of a nuclear war. And I take umbrage at all of this, you know, well, St. Faustina said in 1936 that such and such would happen in Poland. Okay, but this is 2022. We are living moral actors in this day and age, and we have responsibilities to our fellow man, which includes Russian human beings who also happen to be Christians, our fellow Christians. And so I just want to put that out there and say, you know, please examine the harder foreign policy questions, the harder moral questions that have led our foreign policy establishment to this horrible place.
All right, Ken. First of all, thank you. I appreciate you specifying your thoughts on that. You have a right to feel as you feel. And if it offends you that the church's role in this, and specifically something like Fatima and what did you mention, St. Faustina and the Divine Mercy, if that offends you, if it riles you, okay, you have a right to feel that way if you wish. Most people don't tend to feel that way. And although I have not talked about St. Faustina on this program, I presume you're probably talking about Drew Mariani's program, and I haven't heard whatever it is that he said. So all I can tell you is on my program, and I don't know to what extent you've heard all of what I've had to say on this issue, but when this first started up last week, I spent 3 hours talking about the geopolitical issues here, the moral problem that we have in the West, and the way in which the narrative is being considered from both perspectives. I spent a great deal of time on that, and I guess from what you're saying, if you're indicting me in your comments, that you didn't hear what I had to say on the issue. So I would respectfully invite you to go back, look back into last week, and the show notes are in each of the hours, so you can see what I was talking about it in what is written there, and then you can pursue it if you're interested. Now, if you're not interested, okay, that's fine too. But there is room for this discussion about Fatima. It's certainly pertinent if you ask me. But let's talk about the more pressing issue that you raised, Ken, and that is the moral problem that we have right now. I would caution you, sir, very strongly, to be careful in not letting your emotions run away with you on the basis of the narrative that is being shaped for you wall to wall 24/7 by the mainstream media. Furthermore, I would caution you from letting your emotions, you know, get away from you by, on the other side of things, looking at the spin, and much of it is spin, if you ask me, that is saying that, well, Russia's really not the one at fault. Ukraine is the one that's at fault. In the next hour, I'm going to talk about a recent development as of this morning in which the Russian defense minister publicly said yesterday that they have found chemical weapons and they want to know what are the Americans and the Ukrainians planning to do with these biological and or chemical weapons. So I have a lot to say on that topic. But there are two competing narratives here, and neither one is completely accurate if you ask me. I personally have said publicly, Ken, maybe you didn't hear me, that what is happening in Ukraine is a crime. What Putin is doing is evil, and he must be stopped, and we have a role to play in it. But what exactly that role is, it's hard to know, because as soon as we put troops or tanks or airplanes into that theater against the Russians, we suddenly become at World War III. With all that that entails, and the very possible or even likely scenario of nuclear war resulting. There was, I think, I don't know if you heard me yesterday, I was talking about the editor-in-chief of RT, one of the main Russian news organizations, who quit her job because she says, we are standing on the brink of nuclear war, and in Russia, the people don't know about that. So all of this to say, Ken, I agree with you that it's a very important moral issue. We have a moral imperative to help. A lot of what is being said in the mainstream media is, in my view, it's like a hall of mirrors where you can't fully know in any given case to what extent are some of these things actually true. But if nothing else, and I'll throw it back to you, if nothing else, I'm hopeful that you and I can at least agree on the point you were making, that we do have an obligation to help these people. Yes, they're our fellow Christians, so are the Russians, that's all true. But notwithstanding the fact they're human beings and they're innocent and this attack on their country is wrong and it's evil. So for my money, the question now is, how do we best do that without involving ourselves in World War III and risking the possibility of countless billions of people being blown to smithereens by nuclear weapons? That's a big part of this issue, if you ask me. So I'll throw it back to you, Ken.
Yes, I agree. And I would say that any military involvement whatsoever, including no troops on the ground, but sending arms or sending participating with Poland, as was reported yesterday, Poland wants to give Ukraine some MiG jets, and so then the U.S. is supposed to refill them. That is participating in an act of war. That brings us into war with Russia.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And I am completely against that, and I think it would lead to possibly a nuclear war. And yes, it is tragic that what Putin is doing is evil. It is pure evil. But the larger evil would be a nuclear war. And we have, and part of the self-examination for us individually, collectively as a church, is what have we been doing really in the last, since the fall of the Soviet Union to get rid of nuclear weapons? It's not a big priority for the Catholic Church. They'll issue statements. There was a statement from the U.S. bishops back in the 80s about nuclear abolition. Okay, fine. But it's just not a hot burning issue. It's not, but in our time, it's not a hot burning issue. And we haven't done the legwork to improve our foreign policy, our grasp of the human condition,
hey, Ken,
and so
here's
forth.
Here's the thing, though. The Catholic Church doesn't run American foreign policy. You know, the Pope is not the Secretary of State. We don't have a say in any direct way. We do indirectly through voting, etc. But we don't have the Pope can't pick up the red phone and call the President of the United States and say, stop that. Stop building bombs. We don't have that ability. So in my view, at least if I'm understanding you correctly, I think your argument is somewhat wrongheaded here if you're indicting the Catholic Church as such for the problems in American foreign policy, not to mention European foreign policy toward Russia. It's a big old mess, and it's simply facile and way too simplistic to suggest, as it sounds to me like you are, that the Catholic Church ultimately is responsible for it because we didn't do what? What is it the Catholic Church didn't do that it could have done to change foreign policy?
Well, if
tell me that.
Well, I don't think the Catholic Church can change foreign policy as such, but there is a Catholic president, there's a Catholic speaker of the House. Catholic,
you can't
the
even
United
get
States
these people
power
to stop killing unborn babies, Ken. We can't even get them to stop killing our own unborn American citizen babies. Yeah, I mean, quote-unquote Catholic president, quote-unquote Catholic speaker of the House. Come on.
But what I'm saying is the emphasis on peace, denuclearization, peace with Russia, all of these things have just not been front burners in Catholic consciousness for the last,
all right,
certainly in my adult life.
Okay, so let me do a thought experiment with you here, Ken, okay? To whatever extent what you just said is correct, and I'm willing to go down that road with you, okay? But let's look in our thought experiment at how front and center, front burner, boiling hot, the issue of abortion has been in this country, and we have not been able to move the needle hardly an inch with the so-called Catholic politicians, with our so-called Catholic president, with our so-called Catholic speaker of the House, and all those Catholic senators, and all those Catholic congressmen. In the last 50 years now, since Roe versus Wade, we haven't been able to fix that, and that has been as front burner as anything could possibly be. So why would we imagine that if we haven't been able to fix that problem, that by doing the same thing, we are somehow going to change American foreign policy and the nuke building program? I don't see that. I don't see it happening.
I see your point, Patrick. But I want to maintain that the notion that our collective consciousness as Catholics across the political spectrum is lacking so bad in foreign policy. And you can see that in Afghanistan and spending $6 trillion and more lives lost. I mean, it's all over the place.
I agree. That's a big mess.
Life is precious, and we're just not devoting the time. So getting back to my original point, when I called in, when I see, you know, mystical, and I believe in the mystics. I love St. Faustina. I love the saints, and of course Our Lady. But when I see this, I don't know, it's like a mantra almost. I want to say, okay, but this is not asking the hard questions of our leaders. And we expanded NATO. Russia is under threat. You said that's a narrative. It seems rational to me.
I'm not saying that Russia's under threat, that's a narrative. What I was saying, Ken, is that there are people who are pushing the narrative that Russia's not really doing anything wrong. That Russia, Putin is justified, they say, in doing what he's doing because we have gay pride parades and he doesn't want gay pride parades. Or we here in the United States are decadent and immoral, which we are, and he doesn't like that stuff. Therefore, he's really justified in going into Ukraine. And what about all the people that were being killed in Ukraine for the last 10 years by the Ukrainians? That's the narrative that I was referring to earlier, Ken.
On the cultural thing, I think that has no standing. Those people aren't thinking clearly. They have a distorted view of what's of priorities. We need to prevent a nuclear war, and they're talking about gay pride parades. But on the other point, that the Ukrainian government is also corrupt, it's so true. We have no business. There was a report that the HHS, Health and Human Services, spent tens of millions of dollars giving mainstream media propaganda to pay them propaganda about the vaccines. That is just core.
I agree.
Anti-democratic corruption of our government and people.
I agree, but it doesn't exonerate. And this is something I said earlier, Ken. I'm getting close to my break, so forgive my interruption. All of those things notwithstanding. And I can agree with you on these points. They still do not exonerate Putin from doing what he's doing in Ukraine. Even if Ukraine, you know, the analogy I used the other day, Ken, was, you know, it's like saying, well, she deserved to get raped because of the dress she was wearing. And that is the attitude that some people, not you, but some people are promoting this view that it's Ukraine's own fault. That's what's happening to Ukraine because they pushed and pushed and pushed. And now Putin had no choice but to do this to them. And I strongly deny that theme. I'm down to my last 60 seconds, Ken. I'll give you the final shot before I have to go.
Okay. I agree with that Putin is evil. He is to blame for it. But we also have to take responsibility for how we got ourselves into this situation. And that includes a lot of old-fashioned Catholic self-examination, individually and collectively, not just patting ourselves on our back about how much we love our Blessed Mother. That's really kind of the point I want to get across.
What form would that take? Can you give me something specific, Ken? Because that's where I draw a blank. What are you proposing exactly?
Rigorous discourse. And you said you've had some of it. Maybe I've missed some of it. I don't know. But
we're doing it right now.
Rigorous discourse from multiple perspectives. And not just people who obviously would just reiterate the CNN propaganda and all that.
Right.
But it's got to be about NATO. What's our role in NATO? Why are we?
Ken, I got to run. I apologize. I got to run. Thank you. It's been a great call. Call me back. And what you're asking for, keep in mind, we just did for the last 15 minutes. Thanks, Ken. Now.